Hello, this is Terrence McNally, and welcome to Free Forum, a world that just might work. I'll be speaking today with Joan Williams, founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California, and the author of White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Let me start out by saying that I've been doing these conversations since the mid-90s, when I took a hiatus in 2014. But then after Trump's Electoral College victory, I felt like I needed to deal with the causes, the repercussions, and the response in some new interviews. And this is the 32nd such interview. Paul Hawken on climate change, Naomi Klein on No Is Not Enough, David K. Johnston on the daily dirty work of the Trump administration, etc. The show streams weekly on the Progressive Voices Network on TuneIn. And podcasts are available anytime, anywhere on iTunes, Podomatic, and at my site, terrencemcnally.net. And the show airs on KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles. Now, a plug for participation. Let me offer you a few websites with information on how to confront the Trump agenda and work toward the healthy and just future we need. The most organized, kind of the leading organization, I think, is indivisibleguide.com. IndivisibleGuide1word.com, national organization with 5,000, at least 5,000 local chapters. OurRevolution.com is one that grew out of the Bernie Sanders campaign. That's one word, Our Revolution. MoveOn.org and CourageCampaign.org are a couple of organizations, Move On nationally, Courage Campaign in the state of California, that have for a decade at least, been primarily digital, but in the last couple of years, they've aligned themselves more closely with on-the-ground grassroots organizing. And then two very specific are 5calls.org, and that's the number 5 and the word calls, 5calls.org, and townhallproject, all one word, .com, townhallproject.com. 5calls tells you what are the most timely, relevant calls you might want to make to your representatives these days, and Town Hall Project tells you when your representatives are going to be holding town halls near you so you can go and meet them in person. And you can email me at temcnally@mac.com if you want more info about any of this. T-E-McNally, T-E-M-C-N-A-L-L-Y at mac.com. Now to today's guest. A friend emailed me Joan Williams' Harvard Business Review article, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class. It was published immediately following the 2016 election, although it was sent to me when they heard my interview in the last 2 or 3 months, Arlie Hochschild, on her book, Strangers in Their Own Land. This article, What So Many People Don't Get About the U.S. Working Class, has been read by over 3.7 million people and is the most read article in the Harvard Business Review's 90-year history. And I can see why. Near the top, Joan Williams writes, For months, the only thing that surprised me about Donald Trump is my friend's astonishment at his success. What's driving it is the class culture gap. And one little-known element of that gap is that white working class resent professionals but admire the rich. And that's a key insight, a key sort of cultural insight that we will talk about. Near the conclusion of the article, she writes, The biggest risk today for me and other Americans is continued class cluelessness. If we don't take steps to bridge the class culture gap, when Trump proves unable to bring steel back to Youngstown, Ohio, the consequences could turn dangerous. Now, as I've mentioned before in this show, soon after the 2016 election, I discovered a quote from Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, most famous for writing The Little Prince. And this quote really struck me as outlining one of our major tasks. And he wrote, If you want to build a ship, don't drum up the men to gather wood, divide the work, and give orders. Instead, teach them to yearn for the vast and endless sea. And my reading of that is, how do we do that in 2018? How do we generate a vision of the future that is as welcome, compelling, and inviting and real as the past that too many seem fondly to remember and want to go back to? One of my thoughts, and I'll put this out there and Joan Williams can respond to it, is that if America is a spirit as much as it is a place or a people, it feels to me that California, if you will, the state that Hillary won by 2 million, embodies America, and the folks at Trump rallies, we're talking about the spirit, perhaps do not. Most of this country's achievements have been driven by an exceptional sense of invention and dynamism. We were settled by immigrants who had that sense. And that's what led to the founding of this nation, as well as its development over the last couple of centuries into the world leader in so many respects. We owe our success to innovators, chance takers, entrepreneurs, those who thrive with novelty and change. And that pretty much describes immigrants. They took that approach their lives or they wouldn't have moved here. And this goes back to, 1700s, 1800s, 1900s, and last week. So it makes sense that they then take that approach to their work, and it's not just a nice poetic notion. The data actually reflects it, that immigrants work hard, start lots of new companies, and so on. So today we're going to talk about Williams' analysis and its meaning in terms of telling an authentic and inviting story and in bridging that class-culture gap so that we begin to work together for things that are good for all of us instead of being split apart by each side's feeling of loss or resentment. A distinguished professor of law, Hastings Foundation Chair, and founding director of the Center for Work-Life Law at the University of California Hastings College of Law, Joan Williams has authored 11 books, including What Works for Women at Work, co-written with her daughter, Rachel Dempsey. And Sheryl Sandberg and LeanIn.org had Williams create short videos sharing that book's strategies, and the videos have been downloaded over 975,000 times. And her latest book, the one we're focusing on, is White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. Welcome, Joan Williams, to Free Forum, A World That Just Might Work.
Delighted to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And let me tell listeners, we're recording this conversation Friday, August 31st, 2018. Now, I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we talk about here. And so I cited a few highlights, but can you tell us in your own words a bit about your path to the work you do today? And feel free to mention mentors, inspirations, turning points, moments of decision.
Well, I was that generation of professional women who really didn't have mentors. But I am basically carrying on a family tradition of crossing social taboos. My father, who was a New England WASP, married my mother, who was a New York Jewish girl, in 1947. I have been interested in social inequality my entire career and working on it in various different ways for the past 40 years. I've chiefly focused on gender and the interaction between gender and race, but I have also focused on social class. And typically, before Trump's election, my stuff on gender kind of walked out the door into the culture. And my stuff on class was met with a crashing silence.
Mm-hmm.
The night that I realized Trump was going to be elected, I made a second try. And this time, we have Mr. Trump to thank for the fact that we now have a conversation, a robust conversation about social class in America.
I would agree. I would agree. I went into it, hinted, I read one thing, two little quotes from the article, and the article, I assume, led to the book. And the book is, by the way, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America is a, what's the word I'm going to say? It's not intimidating. Before the notes, 134 pages. So it's not an article, but it's not a tome. You can pick it up, you can read it, and it's a quick read. Even though being an academic, she's got plenty of footnotes in the back. It's something that worth picking up and taking on. So
my goal was to have it go down like a smoothie.
Yeah, there you go.
And it's organized around questions that people we're asking then, right after the election, and are still asking now, aren't Trump voters just racist? And why does the working class not move where the jobs are?
Mm-hmm.
So it's designed to answer questions that are kind of come to top of mind.
Right. And basically, she's being literally true. Each chapter is a question. Why talk about class? Why does working class resent the poor? And the couple that she mentioned. And finally, at the end, why are Democrats worse at connecting with the white working class than Republicans? But each chapter is the answer to one of those questions. And I'm assuming this grew out of the comments to your article. It grew out of when you would give talks on it and people would respond and so on. And so I find that a very helpful structure. Obviously, that's what I do on the air. It's all questions.
Yeah, well, it actually grew out of the mind of my brilliant editor, Sarah Green Carmichael.
Excellent.
But
so the premise that article was sort of mounting in you, you know, over I'm sure the months and weeks prior to the election, and then was published the day after the election, if I'm not mistaken. What drove you, and what do you think are the key premises, the key points?
Well, what drove me is that Trump won,
and you suspected.
I had published most of this in an academic book published in 2009, which grew out of the Massey lectures that I gave at Harvard at that time, titled Obama Eats Arugula, talking about how Democrats have a hard time connecting with working-class whites. That book, as I mentioned, fell like a stone, and I just figured that was the one that got away. And one of the reasons it does is that talking about class it presents very specific challenges to the college-educated elite, because it interferes with a story they tell themselves, which is that the reason they're on top is because they work hard and they're the smartest people around. And that's, I always say, yeah, I work hard, but so do hotel housekeepers. The reason that my hard work has paid off has everything to do with class privilege. But the admitting that requires one to admit that not only have you been the recipient of racial privilege and perhaps gender privilege, but also class privilege.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, the instinct of higher status groups is always to stereotype lower status groups as kind of dim-witted. And that's why they are where they are. And traditionally, men did this to women. Traditionally, whites did this to people of color. Sometimes they still do today. But as the college-educated elite in the United States has kind of learned to run that through their heads and try to self-correct for that when it comes to gender and race, what I'm trying to urge them to do is to run it through their heads when they do that by class and just, for example, write off all Trump voters as racist, sexist, deplorables.
Yeah. And let me say, by the way, I listened to a couple of your TEDx talks, and in one of them, the biggest applause line of the within the talk, there was applause at the end, but the biggest applause line within the talk was when you made that point that when it becomes as not okay to deride class as it does race or gender, then we're on our way. And that in the crowd was the biggest applause line.
Yeah, and I mean, that kind of class cluelessness and condescension just plays directly into the hands of the far right. The far right is taking the economic pain of the American middle class, which is very, very well documented, and urging those folks to turn that into racism and to interpret it through the lens of race. The reason that I have lost touch with the American dream is because I'm a white person. So that's what the far right is offering as an interpretation. What everybody else across the spectrum, from progressive to mainline conservative needs to be saying is, no, your economic pain is real. We're going to address it. It's caused not by the fact that you're a white person, by race. It's caused by class. And we need, what we need to do is to to address the issues in the American economy that have created the situation whereby, for example, virtually every American born in the 1940s did better than their parents. But for those born 40 years later, it's less than half. That is the disappearance of the American dream. People have every right to be extremely upset about it, and they are.
Yeah, and one of the I mean, believe me, Joan, I have been pounding this for for as long as I can remember. But the real wages in America rose quite steadily from the Depression to 1973. And except for occasional blips since then, that has not been the case. It was not in the case in the go-go 90s. It was not in the case in the crazy go-go early 2000s. It has not been the case since the recession. It has been that real wages do not rise, and so there you are. You were brought up to, your whole culture was based on that sort of model, that people who played by the rules, I mean, I'm quoting Bill Clinton, aren't I, played by the rules, worked hard, and so on, could have at least as good or better a life than their parents. And that basically was prolonged only, I think, this is in action again since the recession, was prolonged only by overuse of credit and credit cards and so on to kind of keep the illusion, or refiing your house, which led to was a big contributing factor of the crash and how devastating it was. So I just
Would be double what they are today if wages had continued to rise when productivity did.
Right.
Now, is that a problem caused by low-income people of color? No. It is not attributable to race. It is attributable to class. The average CEO used to earn 27 times more than the average worker. Now it's 270.
Yeah, and what you saw, I mean, I think strategically, and you've made the point already in this conversation, but that can be used by the far right. That two things that happened, as I said, 73 is when real wages stopped rising. 70 is when Lewis Powell wrote the Powell memo, sort of saying business, we got to get our act together. And the fact that those two things have been running in parallel ever since, that is to say that the middle class and the working middle class have been getting a decreasing share of American prosperity at the same time as the right has been working hard to stoke their feelings of being left out. I think that those two things in parallel create a great deal of what we're talking about today.
Yeah, I mean, Trump said, you're the forgotten people.
Yep.
I'm going to bring you back jobs.
Yeah. Just now, as Nixon said, you're the silent majority.
Yeah. I'm a San Francisco liberal. I don't think that's the program. I don't think that's what's going on. But he listened to them. They felt listened to. And I think that the far right is offering is an economic populism that's intertwined with racism. The only effective response is an economic populism that isn't. And that should not be controversial. I mean, this is what Martin Luther King was talking about when he said, equality means dignity, and dignity means a paycheck that lasts through the week. And, you know, I'm going to take a little bit issue with your description of America at the top of the podcast, of people who are willing to take risks and who embrace novelty and change. I do think that's an important set of themes in American history, but I think an equally important set of themes is that the people who came to America both hundreds of years ago and today, sometimes they're those romantic dreamers who like to live on the edge, but often they had no alternative but getting murdered or poverty. And they're coming here to establish a stable middle-class life. They are not interested in novelty. They are not interested in change. They are interested in stability. And I think that's true of many. It's true of the white working class, and it's true of many of the working class of color. The taste for novelty, change, innovation, those are elite tastes. Those tastes, which I completely share, reflect a certain level of class privilege that takes economic stability for granted and takes for granted a cultural context where, I mean, I've been rewarded for novelty and innovation my whole life. But, having an attitude in a blue-collar job, that just gets you fired.
Yes, you make that point very well, that's the attitude that you bring to your entrepreneurial life is the attitude that gets you fired in your workaday life. One thing I would say, though, is what I was trying to point out was that many countries have stable working sort of cultures, and that what separated America to some extent was that it seemed to have sort of inventiveness on overdrive.
We steal the smartest people throughout the world. I mean, it's a fantastic strategy.
Exactly. And when we cut down on immigration, we're telling some of those smartest people to stay away.
They're staying home.
Yeah.
They're leaving. They're going. Actually, one of the TEDx talks, one of the other speakers was somebody who had been born in India, who had been living in the U.S. and was about to leave for Canada because he was going like, I don't feel comfortable here.
Yeah. Yeah. The truth is, we can't afford it up and down the line. And let me just go back to one other thing you said. Yes, I mean, I think that people who forget that Martin Luther King, even though his career was as short as it was, he died at 39, had shifted his message towards the end was about poverty, and it was about class. And it was about poor whites and poor blacks and poor immigrants having a fair shake, and that when that is lost, we are in big trouble.
Trying to remedy a long-standing American tradition that was in place by 1670, whereby elites kept on top by ensuring that there was a wedge between people of color who were non-elite and non-elite whites, often called, by the way, white trash.
Mm-hmm.
You understand why they're upset. that was christened by somebody the wages of whiteness strategy of saying to non-elite whites, well, your wages may be really crappy, but at least you're white.
Yeah.
And you're paid more than people of color, and you're given more honor than people of color. And that wages of whiteness strategy is what Martin Luther King was very well aware of and was trying to remedy against, through the Poor People's Campaign. What's happened now is that the far right is using the wages of whiteness strategy again and encouraging economically disenfranchised whites and economically anxious whites to interpret the problem as those people of color, those immigrants who have stolen your jobs and driven the wages down. And the instinct has often been to say, oh, no, immigrants are great for the GDP. And my attitude is like, that's irrelevant. People don't live averages.
No, exactly.
GDP is an average. People live where they live. These people often live in, they don't live on the chic blue coasts. They live in that ocean of red in the middle of the country. Non-elites of all races are much more reluctant to move than elites are. This is as true of African-American mothers in the middle city, as it is true of blue-collar whites in Kansas. And the reason that elites are more likely to move is, you know, we go to college and we have national and international networks, global networks, by the time we're 22. And we've seen a lot, and we have that economic stability from which to build those global networks, which are completely vital for our careers. So we're brought up to be able to, quote, network and to interact comfortably with people we don't know and to build a broad network of acquaintances. Non-elites are not brought up that way. They don't have the opportunity to meet people from all over the country and the world. They often they live their whole lives in the small, dense clique networks of family, friends, and neighbors that they grew up in. And that's all they know. That's the way they get jobs. That's the way they get social honor. They're not just some guy who sells toilets. They're a man of considerable moral stature. And so there's just part of the class cluelessness is not to understand that class deeply shapes the common sense that we're brought up with. And the refusal to move reflects that common sense, including the, you know, at some level I'm just a material girl, the material dimension of, you know, to move all the way across the country for a blue-collar job. First of all, that's not the way people get blue-collar jobs. Secondly, you need not one blue-collar job. You need two, because these families need two earners. And you need those jobs to make so much more money that now that you have to pay for child care, elder care, all the things that you got for free when you were in your original clique network, you have to still come out ahead. It doesn't make sense for many people.
Yeah, no, I mean, a couple of points that you're making there. One, that thing about that you need to actually decide to move with the expectation that you are both going to find jobs and that those parts of life that have been absolutely monetized in urban centers, many of them are done by extended family or extended community in rural areas. And when you leave, you are giving that up. So the cost benefit analysis makes sense.
It's a way that non-elite families protect themselves from their disadvantaged place in the market. I mean, they don't want to buy child care at $2.50 an hour.
$2.50 an hour? That's amazing.
Well, that's actually sometimes that's what child care subsidies are sometimes. That much.
And by the way, one of the things that I think goes also to what you're saying is that when we're talking about novelty and the chance of elites to have these global networks and so on, is that the highest, I think research is showing, that the highest anti-immigrant prejudice is in places with the lowest population of immigrants, and that the lowest anti-immigrant prejudice is in places with the most immigrants. And so partially it's that if your insecurity and your fear is being kindled by someone, the less real experience you have to counter that, the easier it is to gin it up.
That's true. From what I understand from the studies, I mean, human beings are very imaginative. We can think up really scary stuff.
Yep. Yep. And we're evolutionary predisposed to do exactly that because that's scary.
Yeah, I also think it's important, though, to understand that immigrants are not only, I mean, I'm here in San Francisco and, you know, I see immigrants all the time.
Yeah.
I think they're the American dream. But one of the things that's happened is that you've had large numbers of immigrants into rural areas that have to work in chicken processing plants, for example. And the sense of people in those areas is often that immigrants have driven wages down. And the instinct, I think, often is to say, no, they haven't. On balance, you do the sophisticated economic analysis,
right,
and you say that on balance, the immigrants have helped the local area. And I think a much more effective response is to say, you know, if people who own those chicken factories have pitted Native American workers, you know, Native people born in the U.S. against immigrants, and used immigrants to drive wages down, whose fault is that? Not the immigrants. They're just trying to support their families too.
Right.
It's the owners of the factories. Let's not talk about race here. Let's talk about class.
Exactly. And it's the class that has, in a concerted effort, actually even a new energy to that effort in this current Congress under Trump, to dismantle unions. I mean, very much of what we're talking about, when we're talking about wages being driven down and so on, all of that.
Dismantling of unions is a key factor in why we are where we are.
Yeah, and the, you know, the notion to actually decimate them more and more, it has an absolute political end. It isn't just that it will it'll help the owners of the factories, but it will disempower the Democratic Party wherever it happens, and that makes the going easier. A couple of things that that I want to get back to, and I appreciate this back and forth, as you know, because I feel what we're trying to do is get underneath, as you do repeatedly, underneath statistics, underneath glib sort of answers that, while on the face of them they may be accurate, they may not be relevant or practical if we're going to actually solve these problems. But one of the things that you pointed out that I'm going to quote you right here. One little element of the gap is that the white working class resents professionals but admires the rich. And you made this point specifically in terms of Trump, although I think it goes, you know, it goes well beyond Trump. But talk about that for a second.
Yeah, the white working class, and this is from ethnographies of the white working class, of which there are like 40 years. And they tend to resent professionals because it's professionals who order them around every day. I mean, one of these ethnographies refers to a blue collar guy, referring to quote some college kid who doesn't know crap about my job but is perfectly willing to tell me how to do it. So there's a resentment of professionals, and they resent the bureaucrats who make them jump through 14 hoops in order to get what they need, including, you know, the licenses for their small businesses. That's another part of the resentment of professionals, which, of course, the far right has sculpted into a general anti-government furor in the United States, so that people hate government, even though they love lots of government programs.
Yep.
So the resentment of professionals makes sense in terms of their structural class position. What is harder to understand is why the white working class so deeply admires the rich. By the way, there's some differences here by race, and there's not a lot of research in it, but my intuition is there's a lot of similarities across blue-collar people of different races. But the white working class, which is where the literature is, they admire the rich because they don't want to turn into professionals. They see professionals as kind of ineffectual pencil pushers who spend their whole life sucking up to each other, because that's what an office job is, after all. So they don't want to turn into professionals. And it's kind of, it's like inconceivable to do so. I mean, again, these are people
right.
who are brought up with a respect for stability, for tradition, for community. And professionals, studies show, value community less and individual achievement more. they value family less, and in the view of the humble opinion of the of working class people, they mistake their jobs for a life. And so they don't want to turn into professionals. What they want is to live their own lives in their own class culture, but with more money. They want to, these are order takers who want to be order givers, but they don't want to change anything else. And so that's one of the many reasons why Donald Trump channels this group so perfectly. Because, you know, you think about what Donald Trump has done his entire life. It's basically built a bad-taste version of luxury from my elite standpoint.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of built the non-elite image of what it means to be rich. So it's not the Plaza, it's Mar-a-Lago. And Donald Trump, although, you know, he is a poor little boy who started out with, what was it, a $14 million loan from his father.
Yeah, yeah.
He also is a boy from Queens.
Yeah.
And he's been condescended to by Manhattan elites his entire life. He hates elites as much as his white working class supporters do.
It's all relative. In other words, to the guy from Queens, he hates the elites. To the working person in Arkansas, he hates the elites, but the visceral feeling, as you describe, is what we relate to.
And the fact that elites, that Trump drives, you know, my crowd to distraction. Oh man, that's fantastic! Like the white working class, they finally got to us. You know, so the more outlandish Trump gets, the happier they are, because the more outraged we are, this is a class dynamic.
Yes.
We're being played.
Well, one thing that I really, during the last 2-3 weeks of the campaign, I, like you, was very fearful of how this would turn out, A, because I understand the Electoral College, but B, I felt that criticizing Trump, especially saying he was unfit, which was basically all I saw Clinton commercials doing toward the end of the campaign. It backfires because I'm white working class. Here is a billionaire, macho TV star finally listening to us, taking our side. Of course you've got to say he's unfit. Correct? I mean, isn't that the dynamic you see as well?
You know, it is. And the fact that, I mean, it's just kind of unlucky that you have the Mueller investigation falling into this narrative as well, like, oh, the elites hate him. They're going to get him however they can get him. Now, you know, we might get him because he is, like, crooked. But that doesn't erase the fact that this the whole set of legal problems that Trump has just plays into this narrative of that the elites absolutely hate me. And it's been interesting. I mean, I've spent a lot of time talking to the Democratic Party, and Democratic electeds and candidates, they're not spending a lot of time in most places attacking Trump. I think because they understand that people have heard a lot of attacks on Trump. This is nothing new. And so that's not the best way to bond themselves to their base, and it is really a bad way to reach beyond the base.
Yeah, yeah. I think that the thing that makes, that's different now is that to some extent the evidence is out there. You can feel about it however you want. You know, you don't have to claim he's unfit. He displays it every day.
Yeah.
You
see this kind of frantic masculinity of like, okay, my button's bigger than your button. What?
Yeah.
Just go like, Donald, this is not about your button.
Yeah. But I mean, back then, at that point, when it should have been about the vision, a vision of the future, a vision of even the next 4 years that was going to be inviting. It was all anti-Trump, and a point when I really do think I'm a voter saying, you're picking on the guy that finally takes my side. Finally,
I hear you. Yeah. You know, having also written the book called What Works for Women at Work, the Clinton campaign was thinking through the lens of gender, and they were thinking they were responding to a very well-established pattern of gender bias that shows that women have to literally be more qualified than men in order to be seen as equally competent. And that was front and center for them. So they kept saying, oh, she's super qualified, you know. Her ex may not be longest, but her resume is, from a gender standpoint. And so what they didn't understand is they didn't understand certain gender dynamics, but they like that it is optional for a man to be likable, but not optional for a woman to be likable. So they don't even understand the gender dynamics completely, but they were completely class clueless. They had no idea what was going on from a class standpoint.
And you're saying partially even more than, I mean, it's, and of course you make the point that Hillary Clinton's husband was probably the Democrat, who related best to the white working class, and yet, but I think it's interesting what you're saying, that if you look at it from a gender perspective, then qualification means enormous, it has enormous weight. And yet when you step outside of it and you say, wait a minute, that's not who I'm speaking to. I'm speaking to the whole country, and this election's going to be won in some states where I'm not speaking to those people at all.
Yeah, I mean, and that's one of the things that's been disheartening. It's like, you know, hey, do the math. What don't you understand about this? there's a robust story on the left that we're headed towards a majority-minority country, and literally in talks, people sometimes say, we just need to let these,
die.
People die off.
Yep.
And I have two responses. Number one, do you understand why they don't like you? Number one. That's very disrespectful, right?
Yes.
You're being disrespectful of people because of who are lower on the social totem pole. That's kind of not what the ideal is. And number two, the structure of the Electoral College means that rural and Rust Belt whites' votes are overcounted by the Electoral College, and that is not going to change. So even if you don't believe as an ethical mandate that you should treat everybody with respect regardless of their social position, it's just to do the math and realize that you can't write off this group.
Yeah. No, I think that the rural-urban divide in this country, which in some sense, parallels the class divides and so on. But I think it has not been given the prominence that it should when we look at what's going on. Due to the Electoral College and the fact that each state has two senators, whether it's Wyoming with, 550,000 people and California with 35 million, and that almost all state legislatures are also weighted toward the rural.
By the way, we've basically lost access to abortion through most of the country.
Exactly, and that's because of the county system, and counties get representatives and so on. And it's a thing that the founding fathers put in. They needed it to get the South to come along and join in an alliance with those mid-Atlantic trade states, but we live with it. And as you say, do the math. The fact that when you look around, you see one thing doesn't mean that that's going to win you an Electoral College election. Let me, because I don't want us to get out of here without me asking this, what do you think of, and this is going to be everything we've been talking about is society-wide. Now I'm going to get very specific politically. What do you think of Elizabeth Warren? That means three things. One, she just put out a big proposal on revising the corporation. One example, 40% of boards of large corporations would have to be made up of employees. those sorts of things to take away she calls it the accountable corporation rather than these completely soulless elite 1% corporations. And then she also has come up with a very good anti-corruption proposal to actually drain the swamp. I would ask you two things. One, if you're familiar with those proposals, do you think they speak to any of what we're talking about? And two, even more maybe, does she come, in your reckoning, does she look like she might be able to overcome that anti-elite feeling? Is she a different kind of a woman, enough of a different kind of a woman candidate than Hillary Clinton?
You know, I can't. I have learned to say I am a class explainer, not a candidate chooser.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Elizabeth Warren, I think the world of her. I think the world of a lot of other. I think the Democrats have a lot of other strong candidates as well. In terms of what these proposals that you're talking about, and keep in mind, one of the things that Elizabeth Warren did very early was talked about the impact of the bankruptcy system on working class families.
Yep.
And formerly middle class families. That's basically how she made her name. And she comes from modest origins. And so what she is doing is, I think, what other candidates really need to do and are learning to do. Typically, since the 1970s, the Democrat, and this is documented over and over again by political scientists, the center of gravity in the Democratic Party shifted away from unions and blue-collar issues onto cultural issues of more direct interest to college-educated elites. And the center of gravity in the Democratic Party shifted away from unions to the college educated. And the extent to which the focus was on class, it was on people in poverty. And it's important to recognize that the bottom 30% of American households, the poor, are very different economically and culturally from the so-called white working class, which is really another name for the middle. What Elizabeth Warren's corporation proposal does, which I think is very astute, is focuses attention on the class issue of, like, who is really responsible for the hollowing out of the American middle class. And beginning to say, hey, this is a class issue. Let's talk about it as a class issue. And not focus solely, for example, on raising the minimum wage, which mm-hmm. is extremely important, but of very little interest to the middle class. Because the only thing they know about the minimum wage is they don't want it, whether it's $7.50 an hour or $15.
Right.
That's what they're trying to avoid. And so, you know, I'm just a garden variety progressive. I think we should focus on the minimum wage, but I also think we should not kid ourselves. That's going to be of interest to middle-class people, and we need to include in the Democratic Party front and center and insistently issues that are of central importance to people trying to preserve their hold on the middle class at the same time that we highlight proposals for people who are trying to enter the middle class.
Mm-hmm.
Elizabeth Warren is super smart, and she's doing it.
Yeah. I mean, where I was getting in, not necessarily to picking her as a candidate, but just whether I try to ask myself, does she come off as someone who's worked hard and has the back of someone in the middle class and is not, you know, even though she's a Harvard professor, is not just that elite person dictating their lives. And I was just wondering, you know, if you had a, because you did it. I think we both had gut reactions to Trump and to Hillary Clinton that we then figured out what those gut reactions meant, you know. And I
yeah, I actually support supported Clinton quite fervently.
Mm-hmm.
But I did say in an interview shortly after the election that I didn't think we should run another white woman. I have actually reconsidered that, and now I'm kind of agnostic. One of the things that's happened is that gender dynamics have changed unrecognizably in just 2 years, partly because sort of Trump's truculent macho does not play very well, and among large groups of the American public, including, by the way, non-college-educated white women.
Mm-hmm. Even though he won a majority,
also,
didn't he?
Sorry?
He won a majority of them, didn't he?
He won a majority of them, but his support has substantially fallen among them.
Among them,
It's notched up for non-college-educated white men,
mm-hmm.
but fallen considerably for non-college-educated women. And the other thing is that women, remember I was saying that the Clinton campaign was very focused on this first pattern of gender bias of proving that she was competent enough. Now women are using a strategy that we call, and what works for women at work, gender judo, to address that second issue of whether they're likable. And the gender judo move, which is being used by a number of different candidates, including one prominent woman who has a viral video, and the viral video shows her in her kitchen, in her middle-class house with her two kids and her husband, and it looks like her mom or mother-in-law, looking very domestic, and then it cuts to footage of her as a fighter pilot.
Mm.
And what she is basically doing is saying, she's not too masculine to be likable because she's a mom.
Yeah.
But she's not too feminine to be competent because she's a fighter pilot.
Yep.
That's gender judo, is you embrace a feminine stereotype, in this case the mom stereotype, that typically has held women back, and you flip it around to propel your career forward. And that is the kind of sophistication in gender politics, unfortunately, that the Clinton campaign lacked.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm going to lay out one thing here, and then I want to get to kind of, let's say, sort of the recommendations moving forward. But one is an analysis that I've made, and it kind of goes with what you were saying, is that when television advertising became how campaigns were run, which basically is in the 60s and then moving forward, 68 might have been the first where it was prominent, that raised the price tag. Once you raised the price tag, the Democrats began going after the same funders as the Republicans. They went after Wall Street. They went after the wealthy. They went after big corporations. And suddenly the Democratic Party, taking its money from the same place as the Republican Party, did not stand for unions the way they had, did not stand for the middle class the way they had. Their message became messy. And in parallel, both because they were forced to on the defensive and because it's what made them feel good, focusing on the cultural. And so it's really, you know, it's what I think is that the internet now allows you to actually raise a ton of money from the people. And so where technology, I think when campaigns became about TV, the money became dominant and the big money became even more dominant. Now that now that elections may be about the internet, leaving out the Russian interference and the hacking and all of that, it may democratize the funding, which may democratize the policy.
Yeah, like most new technologies, the internet is totally the worst thing that ever happened to us and totally the best thing that ever happened to us. I think your insight is a very important one.
Yeah. And so now we've got about 3 minutes. Your recommendations, because you've done them in your TED Talks, you've done them in your articles, what do you say to people that, A, have to reach these people and invite them?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very simple. First is stop insulting people.
Yep.
I think what we really have is a broken relationship between elite whites and non-elite whites. Everything from, you depictions, persistent cultural depictions of blue-collar guys, white guys, as stupid and fat, like Homer Simpson, you know, Family Guy.
Mm-hmm.
All of that is just, it may have been fun, but it's been very, very costly. And writing off everyone who voted for Trump as just racists, you know, there's a lot of room for racism, and white people, there's a lot of racism. There's a lot of racism among non-elites, and there's a lot of racism among elites. So definitely work on racism, but don't misuse anti-racism as an excuse for class snobbery.
Mm-hmm.
So that's really the first message. And the second message is doing the kind of thing that Elizabeth Warren is doing, and I fervently hope other candidates will also do, is focus on good jobs for people without college degrees. That's incredibly important. It has not been anywhere near the center of Democratic politics for a very long time, and we're paying a very, very steep price for that.
Mm-hmm. And even though Hillary Clinton would say, I am going to do something for you, I have a policy that's going to do training and retraining and everything.
Yeah, it was number 473 of 617.
And it was, if you want to know more about it, just go to my website. Wrong.
Yeah, exactly. That's an example of class cluelessness. I mean, that's the way you talk to, you know.
Yeah.
It works for me, but then I have a public policy degree from MIT.
Yep, exactly. So don't insult, and let's actually look at, I think, you know, so much of it is just look at policies that are going to help them, and find, now that other thing that I mentioned at the top, which we didn't have time to get into, I think, is we've got to find a story of the future that's inviting, rather than that the future is a country run by immigrants and robots, you know.
Yeah.
When I spoke with Arlie, she said it's time for another new frontier.
I think so. I mean, and I think what I would hope, I'm really intrigued by the Warren proposal, but the proposal, I think, that is very easy to explain to people who are, Americans are very frightened about automation and robots,
yeah,
is that pretty soon 60% of jobs are going to require interaction with robots. And so what we as a country need is to set up a new education to employment system where local community colleges and other educational institutions work with local employers to help the employers identify the skills they need and develop certificate programs they trust. Not college degrees, those are great too, but I'm talking about something different. I'm talking about certificate programs developed in conjunction with employers that employers will hire from, and that's how these job training programs are metriced. Not people trained, people hired.
Yeah, and my guess
I
is...
I think that would be tremendously exciting to a lot of people,
yeah,
of all races.
My guess is that's what Germany is doing. They're training...
Germany has always done, because
that's right,
they see what happens when you leave the working class behind.
Yep.
Not a pretty picture.
Yeah, they're beginning to see it now. So, thank you. I mean, we could go on. This is really, we're both, I can feel, chewing on this together. So, again, the website is joancwilliams.com, joancwilliams.com, and her latest book, White Working Class, Overcoming Class Cluelessness in America. And as we pointed out, each chapter starts with a question. It's one that, when you're thinking about how do I approach these issues, it's set up to make it easy to get what she's driving at. So for this conversation and many, many other interviews, articles, transcripts of interviews, and to join me in pursuit of a world that just might work, go to terrencemcnally.net or aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website, terrencemcnally.net or one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. If you want to receive my weekly email announcement telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and usually 7 or 8 timely and relevant articles, you can sign up at my site, or you can email me at temcnally@mac.com. You can also subscribe and listen to the Free Forum podcast on iTunes. You can find years of podcasts at my site, or at iTunes. That includes Michael Lewis, Jeremy Scahill, Naomi Klein, Robert Reich, Van Jones, Connie Rice, just a lot of stuff there. Thanks to George Vassilopoulos at Progressive Voices, and most of all to you, my listeners. Please share this podcast widely. Thank you, Joan Williams, and keep up the good work.
Thank you so much. Thanks for your interest.